I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trust, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
And this is where we look at why what's on the charts is on the charts. And flashing back this week, we're going back 28 years to this week, 1990. We're going to count down the top 20 hits on the Billboard Hot 100 dated June 16th, 1990. Not going to give away what number one was.
But if you read the headline on this, you already know.
Our special guest is, well, not giving it away, Per Gessle of Roxette. Doesn't necessarily mean that Roxette was number one this week. It's a pretty good clue, though.
Oh, if you know Gary, he's very generous with his hints.
Yeah, so that's the focus of this week's podcast, but also a lot of action in this week's top 10, dated June 16th, 2018. So let's get right into the Hot 100 this week. And again, Per Gessle of Roxette, our special guest coming up as we count down the top 20 this week in 1990 on the Chartbeat Podcast right now. This week's top 10.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle?
Number 10. Number 9.
Can't take back the love that I gave you. It's to the point why I love and I hate you, and I cannot change you, so I must replace you. Oh, easier said than done.
Yeah. Menacing.
Number 8.
Frightening. Find help. Sometimes I scare myself. Shit could get menacing. This is America.
Number 7.
Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap.
Get me high like you do.
Number 6.
God's plan.
Number 5.
I hold back sometimes I won't. Yeah. I feel good sometimes I don't. Like,
number 4.
Come through, I need a girl like you, yeah, yeah. Girls like you, love fun and yeah. Me do what I want when I come through, I need a girl.
Number 3. Number 2.
You gotta be nice for what to these niggas? I understand. You got a 100 bands. You got a baby bands. You got some bad friends. High school pics. You was even bad then.
And number 1.
Psycho, little mama bad like Michael. Can't really trust nobody with all this jewelry on you. My roof look like a no-show. Got diamonds by the bolo. Don't act like you my friend when I'm rolling through my hands. So.
And for the first time since December, if you have been waiting for Post Malone to end the countdown, this week is your lucky week. There he is, Post Malone, with the song Psycho, featuring Ty Dolla Sign. The new official number one this week on the Hot 100. for fans of the podcast. You've been hearing this song a lot in the past couple of weeks during this little top 10 recap, always kind of mixed somewhere in there between 2 and 5. But officially at number one, took a little while. We're talking 15 weeks on the chart, which especially nowadays, given that we've seen, you know, 3 songs debut straight at number one recently. You know, songs kind of jump up there quickly thanks to streaming. 15 weeks feels like it, you know, is kind of a scenic route at this point to get to the top of the chart.
You could say it was postponed till it got to number one.
You can say it was postponed. I'll never admit to saying that at all. But yeah, you look at how long that song took to number one. The last song to take at least 15 weeks was Havana for Camila Cabello, which, you know, was sort of a little different because it was the solo song that really got her established. It really started at the bottom of the chart and moved its way up. Psycho, if you guys remember, actually debuted at number 2 and has been in the top 5 for all these 15 weeks. So kind of works out nicely that just in the timing with Nice for What, which had been number 1 for 6 non-consecutive weeks, starting to slide down. This Is America as well. Childish Gambino, which had been number 1 before that, sliding down as well. There really wasn't a song that, you know, that has that kind of massive momentum that's bounding up the chart. So a nice week for Post Malone to just, you know, slide in the top spot. And kind of to that point, Psycho has that sort of rare distinction of being the number 1 song on the Hot 100, but actually not being the number 1 song at radio or in sales or in streaming.
Right.
So to kind of get that perfect storm as well, that's one thing you have to look at, where it's not dominating any one factor that's helping it out, but it's doing, you know, just well enough across the board. Number 2 on radio, number 2 in sales, and number 10 in streaming.
Well, that number 10 is pretty notable because we've seen for so long now, if you're number 1 in streaming, you're very possibly going to be number 1 in the Hot 100. We haven't seen anything be number 1 on the Hot 100, but be as low as number 10 on streaming songs since 2014, Happy by Pharrell. So that was kind of a different era ago in terms of streaming. 4 years is kind of feels like a long time ago in the streaming world.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, you know, the explosion of it, just the user growth. I mean, Apple Music was not a thing 4 years ago. Tidal was not a thing 4 years ago. Spotify was, but it didn't seem like it had the same kind of stranglehold the way it does now. So yeah, I mean, if it was, people were still willing to buy songs.
At the same time though, it's there's not a huge gap between number 1 and number 10 on the streaming songs chart this week, so it's not like it's so far behind. It's actually a pretty close race, just happens to be number 10.
All right, and so as we mentioned, the songs that had been number 1, Nice for What, This Is America, Falling Down, people looking for what might be that next challenger for the number 1 spot. Right now, probably the smart money is on Cardi B. The song I Like It with Bad Bunny, with J Balvin, moving up to a new peak on the Hot 100. You guys just heard it at number 3, so as high as that song has been. Remember, it debuted actually in the top 10 at number 8 when the album came out. Has been a real fan favorite, doing really well in streaming even before it became the official single. Now with the push from the music video coming out a little over a week ago, we've got the radio support kicking in as well. This song, I think a lot of people also kind of have marked as a real song of the summer possibility. So a huge move there. And it's actually not Cardi's only song in the top 5 this week. She's got another one, Gary. She is just racking them up.
Yeah, right before that, Maroon 5 at number 4 with Girls Like You, featuring Cardi B. So originally just a Maroon 5 solo song, but she has joined it for the single. If you've seen that video, it's really a matter of who isn't in the video. It's every woman who's kind of prominent in pop culture right now.
Do you think they just saw Nice for What and said, hey, we can do that too?
So yeah, both songs make huge gains because the videos came out. So big streaming gains, big sales gains. This is actually the greatest jump in the Hot 100's history ever by a group. 90 positions, 94 to 4. So beats, remember this song, Matchbox 20, How Far We've Come. It made an 84 position jump back in 2007. But yeah, record-breaking jump for Maroon 5. Biggest jump of all time on the Hot 100 is Kelly Clarkson, My Life Would Suck Without You, 97 to 1, so 96 spot jump for that song. Cardi B, Trevor, actually was really excited about the Hot 100 this week to have those two songs in the top 5. This is what she said about it.
Yo, I am so happy today. I'm so happy. Like, I can't even believe it. Like, I'm so happy. Well, let me tell ya. So, I like it like that. It's number 3 on the Billboard's Hot 100. And Maroon 5, Girls Like You featuring me, is number 4. Like, bro, I'm so happy. I'm so grateful. I'm thankful for y'all for making this happen. I swear, like, if I was to see God, if I was to see Jesus Christ on my in my dreams today, I will kiss his feet. Like, I really want to give, I wish I could give God a hug, bro. So I'm just going to hug myself and make pretend that I'm hugging God, because this man does so much for me. Thank you so much, y'all.
Yeah, yeah, if you happen to be on Twitter, Cardi instantly, as soon as she found out the news, really put that up. Cardi's been a real chart fan, really her entire journey, you know, as she would always kind of post on Instagram, how Bodak Yellow was moving up the charts. They had a nice little party for her at Atlantic when the song hit number one. She's always been, you know, really conscious of that. And obviously the charts have been really good to her in the past year as well. So a nice relationship going on there.
I just like how authentic her reaction is. It's not a canned PR kind of a quote. That's Cardi B.
Oh, there's nothing canned or you know, stereotypical or anything. You're going to get authentic with Cardi B about anything.
So actually, two other songs new to the top 10 this week. Kanye West, number 8 with Yikes, has all 7 songs from Ye, debut in the top 40 on the Hot 100. Yikes is his 16th top 10. And Juice WRLD also new in the top 10, his first top 10, Lucid Dreams, up 59.
That's, come on, Juice WRLD, killing it. Really, I mean, honestly, I know obviously surprises can kind of come out of left field a lot, but it feels like, you know, with so many superstars doing big things right now, we're talking Drake, Cardi, obviously Kanye's back, Nicki's coming. It feels like, you know, this story kind of has gotten a little lost. I mean, how quickly this song has risen. It was number 1 on SoundCloud for months ago, and really when it hit Spotify, when Interscope got involved, I mean, it's quickly made its way up to the top 10. I mean, this is, how many weeks on the chart is this?
Yeah, just 4.
Just 4 weeks already top 10. That's, you know, ridiculous.
All right, back to 1990, the music I grew up with.
Oh, gosh, back in 1990, I would have been not born.
This week in 1990, 28 years ago, I was between freshman and sophomore year in high school.
What were you like in high school, Gary?
If I can brag for a second, I'd won the high school science fair that year for the second straight year.
Wait a minute, Gary defending his title. Look at that.
So much more interesting on the charts. 1990, going back to this week, 28 years ago, what did the Hot 100 sound like? Let's kick into it. The top 20 this week on our way to number 1. Again, we're going to hear from Per Gessle of Roxette when we get to the top of the chart this week, June 16th, 1990. Let's start counting down at number 20.
On the half shell, they're the heroes for. In this day and age, who could ask for more? The crime wave is high, with muggings mysterious. All police and detectives are...
All right, kids, let's count this thing down, starting with numbers 20 through 16. Remember, this is the Hot 100 this week back in 1990. And coming in at number 20, we have the song Turtle Power by Partners in Crime. I guess maybe in a way this is very much appropriate to set the scene of what was going on in 1990. If you haven't heard the song in its entirety, you're probably maybe wondering, it's a little weird, what are they talking about? Well, it's actually a song they used in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. So maybe that helps settle the scene about why this song would have been a hit, obviously attached to a mega movie franchise at the time. And one of the things that I think that the song does that is kind of maybe a little understated is for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to take on a rap song as something they're going to use in their end credits in 1990.
Yeah,
that's a pretty big, you know, a big move and a big commercial changer for rap, because obviously a lot of rap at this time is, you know, I mean, NWA is hot at this time, you know, Ice-T is hot at this time, Public Enemy is hot at this time. A lot of the big rap making waves is not necessarily you know, the most happy, family-friendly.
Sort of like the only two kinds of rap you had at the time was that, and then sort of the goofy novelty rap, which did pretty well on the charts. So there really wasn't a whole lot of middle ground. You really, there's two extremes, and this was the kind that did pretty well for pop audiences.
yeah, if I had to pick the one that's probably gonna make everyone's appetite a little more settled, yeah, probably gonna be that one. Fun fact, they also get one of the lyrics wrong. They note that Raphael is the leader in the lyrics, but actually it's Leonardo. So hardcore Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fans will appreciate that. All right, so who is Partners in Crime? Because they're not a particularly household name at this point. Two guys out of New York. And even though this song hits number 13 on the Hot 100, there's really not much to say in the way of success after this. They put out another single called Undercover shortly after, but they never release an album. All right, just above them at number 19 on the Hot 100, we got Rub You the Right Way by Johnny Gill. Now, Bruno Mars kind of, you know, is going to be the flag bearer of New Jack Swing, it appears. Certainly with Finesse earlier this year, he took that mantle. But back in 1990, nobody did New Jack Swing better than the men of New Edition. All right, so Johnny Gill, interesting kind of path that Johnny Gill has in music. So he starts out with two solo albums on Atlantic and a duets album with his friend Stacey Ladislaw. Then Johnny joins New Edition when Bobby Brown is kicked out. He's around for some of their later bigger hits, including Can You Stand the Rain, If It Isn't Love, Muscari Chagrin. Johnny Gill is the only member of New Edition not from Boston.
Yeah.
He's not the, yep, he does not wave the Red Sox, Bruins, Celtics flag. Now, Johnny gets a second self-titled album, which is one way to reinvent yourself, in 1990, which has this song, a few other major R&B hits. Teams back up with New Edition, does a few more solo projects into the 90s, then joins another group he forms with Key Sweat and Gerald Levert called LSG, and that trio puts out some albums as well. Now, in recent years, he's returned to touring with New Edition on some of their legacy tours, and get this, joined another group, a splinter group of New Edition called Home State, which is Bobby Brown, Johnny Gill, and Ralph Tresvant. And if that sounds familiar, a trio breaking out a New Edition, it's because they're the three members who did not form Belle Biv DeVoe. So now everybody in New Edition is part of New Edition and a trio branching off a New Edition. So there's like a lot of groups from New Edition going on there.
You're gonna tweet out an image of the family tree.
We might have to break down, you know, literally Johnny Gill's history in visual form. I make it a little easier. But Johnny still records to this day. He's actually had two top 15 hits on our adult R&B songs chart in the past year. One got to number 3 and another at number 11. So, you know, even 30 years into his career, Johnny is still out there commanding huge hits from the R&B audience. And speaking of members of New Edition, you got Bobby Brown right above number 18, helping out Glenn Medeiros with the song She Ain't Worth It. Potentially the first rap song collaboration to hit number one. I know you don't think of Bobby Brown as a rapper, really, but he does do a rap verse in this song. And in 1990, you know, to have a pop singer with a rap verse is a pretty rare feat.
Even to have him featured on a song. You didn't see the word featuring much on the Hot 100. So even that kind of stood out.
Yeah, that kind of gave you a good clue of, you know, it's not a duet. What is this featuring about? So Bobby Brown helping him out there. Glenn Medeiros, lead act on the song, had a couple pop AC hits in this window. Probably most notably, besides this song, Nothing's Gonna Change My Love For You, a number 4 hit on the adult contemporary chart, 12 on the Hot 100. And after his music career ended, he went into the education route, became a vice principal at a school in his native Hawaii.
I'm just wondering if it's tough to be a principal in Hawaii, of all places, because if you're going to skip school, wouldn't Hawaii be maybe the best place to do that? Might be a tough job for him.
Maybe they have, like, you know, I'm sure cops on patrol on all the beaches or something. Yeah. You're not going to get away that easy, kid. All right, above them, number 17, a very famous song, Nothing Compares to You, as done by Sinead O'Connor. Of course, famously written by Prince and first recorded by The Family, one of the R&B groups that he had a hand in back in the 1980s. Of course, O'Connor's cover becomes huge, and a lot of that really also comes from its music video, which is, you know, oddly enough, you know, it's not this big, elaborate music video, but probably one of the best known videos in music history. If you don't know, it's kind of Sinead O'Connor, mostly 90% of the video, just really looking at the camera, singing in heartbreak. And at the end, there's the tears that fall down her face, just a couple. Really poignant, you know, really appropriate for the song, and a huge reception for it. First woman to win Video of the Year at the MTV VMAs, and of course helps propel this song up to number one for 4 weeks in 1990. Now, there aren't too many artists who you can sort of put that pin in and say, this is the moment your career stopped. Unfortunately for Sinead O'Connor, you kind of can.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, you know, the Sinead O'Connor story, a couple years later, she was on an episode of Saturday Night Live singing a cover of Bob Marley's War. During rehearsal, she ripped up a picture of like an infant child. So that's what everyone expected was going to happen. Of course, during the very much live Saturday Night Live, she rips up a picture of the Pope instead, says, fight the real enemy.
That was about as close in a pre-social media era as you could get to everybody just talking about what just happened. That's crazy.
So when the phone's ringing off the hook or the next day at breakfast, at school, was everybody
everyone
like...
Everyone that dialed all those numbers on the rotary phone and we all started talking about it.
Unfortunately for Sinead, a lot of people talked about it, plenty of complaints. And really, you know, I mean, American audiences never really accepted her again. I mean, she's still recorded, she still performs, but, you know, has not come close to that sort of international success and acclaim, which, you know, someone who really has rebelled against sort of the idea of the industry and the establishment and what you should do. You know, she was being herself. It's a very fraught relationship.
She seemed like the type of person who that's more important than just having a bunch of pop hits. She wanted to speak her mind, and good for her for doing that.
Oh, for sure. She always was authentic and very real. I mean, and had no problem speaking out against what she saw as, you know, bullying or attempts to shut her down or shame her or anything.
And just so you don't think I was doing nothing but science projects, I saw Sinead O'Connor in concert in 1990, that summer.
Really?
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes to gauge off sort of one album, one song. How big a phenomenon was she? Did she have a loyal following? Was it a small but mighty following?
The thing I noticed, it was the first time I'd really seen goth kids. Entire audience was pretty much kids in black. And I'd been to pop shows before then. This is a whole new world for me.
Did it run you away?
It was probably my only alternative show for a while. But it was a good show. And she had Emperor's New Clothes was another number one hit on the alternative songs chart after this. So I think she still to this day has a pretty loyal following because I think people respect that she had her own vision.
And talented musician.
Yeah.
She is. Also for Prince fans, of course, who wanted to hear the song, two versions came out after Sinead's song, 1994, a live version with Rosie Gaines. And just this year, Warner Brothers put out a single, which is the studio recording back in 1984, and a video to go along with it. So some of the Prince fans getting some more jewels out of the archive going forward. All right, and at number 16, we got the song Baby It's Tonight by our friend Jude Cole. Now, this song, one of five Hot 100 hits he has between his heyday in 1990 and 1993. Maybe more contemporary fans know him a little bit from some of the liner credits of Lifehouse.
Right.
For those who don't know, he went on to become a manager and a producer and a writer for the band starting in the mid-2000s. Probably most notably, he is a co-writer of the song You and Me, which if you don't know what that sounds like, it goes like this. A number five hit back in 2005. You may not think you know it, but trust me,
you know.
Cause there's you and me, and all other people, nothing to do, nothing to lose, and it's you.
Yeah, get your lighters in the air. A classic from the mid-2000s going on there. This particular song, Baby It's Tonight, feels like, you know, 1990s, a little bit of a, I don't know, in my mind it sounds like a little bit of like a late 80s hangover, yeah, like a the Bryan Adams kind of, yep, sound, like that you associate really strong with like the late 80s. A little soft to be like Bon Jovi, but definitely, you know, if you think of 90s as just, you know, rhythmic R&B, there's still some of the rock guys holding out there.
Interesting thing, I didn't realize this, I was researching. He's married to Lori Pfeiffer. It's Michelle Pfeiffer's sister.
That's Uptown Funk fans. That's some trivia for you.
That's right. he's the original J. Cole as well.
You next. Keep going.
Let's keep going. Number 15 to number 11 this week on the Billboard Hot 100, June 16th, 1990. Numbers 15 through 11 this week on the Billboard Hot 100, 28 years ago, going back to number 15, starting with Richard Marx, Children of the Night. It was up to number 15 on its way to a number 13 peak. Written in support of the Los Angeles-based organization of the same name for Runaways. And if you know that song at the end, there's this long coda. It was arranged by Richard Marx's father. A really great sound at the end of that song. Fifth top 15 hit from his album Repeat Offender, which to this day is his only number one hit on the Billboard 200 albums chart. I'll take this back to the 80s, Trevor. I remember hearing this song about a year earlier before it was a hit when Repeat Offender first came out. Satisfied and Right Here Waiting, they were the first two singles. Both went to number one. WZOU Boston, station doesn't exist anymore, played this song early on. I remember thinking, it's a great song. It took about a year for it to be a single, and in a pre-streaming era, it wasn't like you could really listen to it all the time. The closest you could get is fast-forward the cassette to hear that song.
Fast-forward the cassette.
Back in
the, you didn't have CDs yet?
I didn't really get into CDs till 3 or 4 years later. I still love cassettes. Still have a whole collection.
Do you still play them?
I still have them.
So we've at least, you know, separated from that. That's good.
Number 14, written by Diane Warren, Taylor Dayne, I'll Be Your Shelter, up 17, 14. It would become her seventh top 10 hit on the Hot 100, getting to number four. It's also her last. She had seven top 10s in a row, all from the start of her career, starting in 1987 with Tell It to My Heart, and a single before I'll Be Your Shelter, Love Will Lead You Back, also written by Diane Warren, became her only number one. So 1990, huge year for Taylor Dayne. At number 13 on the Hot 100, boy band Lanier, Sending All My Love. It was down from its number 5 peak. It was their only top 10 freestyle trio from Miami. They did have another hit, and kind of a lost hit at this point, number 30 song in 1992 called TLC, but this is really their best known song, Sending All My Love, at number 13. Number 12, again, sort of like Turtle Power, but this one's probably bigger pop culture-wise in terms of how it's influenced other songs going forward. Digital Underground, Humpty Dance, was at number 12 after hitting number 11, a young Tupac in the video, in the background of this video. So at the time, no one knew really when his career would become so big. But yeah, Humpty Dance by Digital Underground. They had another top 40 hit, too, in 1992, just like Lanier. Kiss You Back hit number 40. But I don't think anyone probably remembers that anywhere on the level of this song. I would think, Trevor, if YouTube memes had existed back in 1990, this song probably would have been really big virally. It was a number 5 sales hit, but only a number 25 airplay hit. So this one was more fans really demanding it. They were buying it, but pop airplay didn't quite know what to do with it.
You know, that's the struggle we find ourselves in, even in 2018, there it has precedent.
Number 11, Hold On by En Vogue. It was up on its way to number 2, recent Billboard Music Awards performers. Song starts with a portion of Who's Loving You. Remember a few weeks ago, Trevor, on the podcast, we played a clip of that song. A young Lauryn Hill performed it at the Apollo. She got booed.
She did. Luckily, you know, that didn't stop her. She went on to make a, you know, huge impact with her solo album.
And En Vogue did too. A bunch of hits in the 90s. This was the first one. And first of two songs called Hold On that we have here on the countdown. It's a good year for songs called Hold On. Before we get into the top 10, just to mention one TV-related thing for 1990. We were 4 episodes into Seinfeld at this point. It had one pilot in July 1989, came back in the spring, summer 1990, had its first 3 episodes at this point, just beginning this time, June 1990.
And other things happening, you know, in 1990, to give us a span of how big 28 years has been, Roseanne, one of the top 3 shows on TV back then. So, you know, for those who may not realize, you know, why Roseanne was rebooted. What was the show? Was it so big? I mean, it was a massive hit in the early 1990s. I mean, obviously so few shows getting revived nearly 30 years after they started. So, you know, that way, I guess a victory for Roseanne regardless.
Moving on. Top 10 this week, 1990, June 16th that year. Numbers 10 through 6.
Oh,
Okay, numbers 10 through 6 this week on the Hot 100. Back.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In 1990, coming in at number 10, kicking us off, Phil Collins, Do You Remember? So this is probably safe to say Phil's sort of last major heyday.
Gave him his last top 10s on the Hot 100.
Yeah.
I guess if you want to put it that way.
I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer, but for someone who's been at the peaks that Phil Collins had been at, you know, in any case, Do You Remember, the third of four top 10s from the album, But Seriously. Probably the best known of which is Another Day in Paradise, which had already been a number one hit by this point, Record of the Year winner at the Grammy Awards. But yeah, after this, Phil has one more top 10 in him that's going to be the very next single. Gary, I know you know. Go ahead and give us, what is Phil Collins' most recent top 10 hit on the Hot 100?
Nice way to put it. Most recent.
Yeah, he's always got a shot.
Something happened on the way to heaven.
Something happened on the way to heaven.
Which was interesting because the first three singles from that album were really all ballads. So it took till the fourth single. He had so many up-tempo hits in the 80s. So he still put out an up-tempo hit in the summer of 1990.
And of course, also in the 90s, does kids everywhere a massive favor by going in on the Tarzan soundtrack. Crushes that. I mean, so many. You'll Be in My Heart, of course, you know, a classic, Son of Man. I mean, all those songs. Phil Collins did that for the kids, and he deserves everything he gets for it. All right, above that, number nine, we got one of the big trends that we're going to see in the 90s kicking off already. Male R&B groups who are just going to go on to dominate so much of the Hot 100 in the coming decade. We've got After Seven at number nine with Ready or Not, the second peaking of their eight Hot 100 hits. The song is on its way to a number seven peak. After Seven, you know, found their heyday in that early 90s period, but really took some time off after 1995. Luckily for their fans, they weren't done yet. They came back in 2016, so, I mean, a 21-year hiatus. The fact they even came back, pretty impressive, but it was a successful run. They've had four top tens on the Adult R&B Songs chart since 2016, including two in the past year, Running Out and Too Late. So just goes to show it's never too late, really, to keep adding those hits, and good to see them back. We've seen a lot of these R&B groups who had their heydays in the 90s coming back in the past 12, 24 months, so good to see a lot of them back. In Vogue, we saw number 11, one of them as well. All right, moving on, number 8 this week, back in 1990 on the Hot 100, the famous MC Hammer, You Can't Touch This, the hit that was probably everywhere. I wasn't alive at that time, but I'm sure, Gary, this song probably was every ballpark, every cookout, every just on the radio, just anywhere you look, there probably was this.
This was actually its peak, number 8, really, because it was only available as a, again, we're going way back here, a 12-inch vinyl single. It wasn't a cassette single at the time, so it just wasn't as available. Otherwise, it really might have been a number one hit, but got to number 8, mostly from airplay, but from some of those sales as well. It was a little harder to find in record stores. But yeah, just massive pop culture hit at the time.
And even though this is obviously MC Hammer's biggest hit, people may be surprised to know he's actually got five top tens on the Hot 100. The other four being songs Have You Seen Her, Pray, Too Legit to Quit, and, of course, Adam's Groove from the Adams Family. So a lot of people may think of MC Hammer as a one-hit wonder, one-album wonder, but he actually, you know, had a pretty good span there for those couple of years. Of course, like most of these sort of novelty rappers, kind of fell into a bit of trouble career-wise as rap started to progress, as it became, you know, East Coast, West Coast, as it became much more commercial, bling-bling era, if you want to call it that. Found it a little hard to adapt to that, and then, of course, ran into some financial problems, so never quite recovered the way that he would have liked, but definitely made his mark, of course, on early 90s, and Parachute Pants, forever synonymous with MC Hammer.
Also, the album, Please Hammer, Don't Hurt Him, was in its second week at number one on the Billboard 200, so even if people couldn't buy the single easily, they were buying the album, number one.
Yeah, huge returns for that album, kind of one of the benefits at that time of not having a single widely available. People still want the song. You can't illegally download it. You got to get it somewhere. Number seven, All Right by Janet Jackson. The song had peaked at number four and had continued her run of top five hits from Rhythm Nation. All in all, she's going to have seven top five hits from this album, which, of course, as chart fans and certainly Janet Jackson fans know, that is the only album in Hot 100 history to have seven top five singles. Still to this day, a record that has been untouched. Another record that Janet's in the middle of is this is her fourth consecutive top 10 hit. She's going to have 14 more going into the 90s for a total of 18 top 10s in a row without missing. That's going to break a record by Madonna that she had in the 80s with 17 in a row. If only Madonna could have had one more top 10. But for Janet to have 18 in a row without missing just shows how big her 1990s is going to be. Going to be the second most successful artist of the 90s behind Mariah Carey. So this is a huge time for Janet Jackson. All right, and at number six, bringing us to the edge of the top five, we got a song by Heart. All I Want to Do Is Make Love to You. And kind of like some of these 80s acts that we've seen that are carrying over, going to have a hard time adapting to the new sounds, the new roads. This is going to be the last top 10 for Heart. The song had peaked at number two 2 weeks prior to this countdown. So a little end of an era for Heart as well.
Yeah, I feel like 1990 kind of was that last year when you had some of those hits that still sounded a little bit 80s, maybe a little bit 1991. But by the end of 91, we were getting Nirvana. Rap was becoming more mainstream. Grunge was taking over rock. So that,
and you had those babyface ballads about to light up radio. Yeah,
those middle ground pop rock songs just didn't do as well later in the 90s. This song, you said, Trevor, got to number two. Always, I remember thinking how big a deal it was when they came back, because Alone had been a number one hit from the previous album. So the Brigade album came out, and this just felt destined to be number one. But stopped at number two. It kind of reminds me of Dancing in the Dark. Bruce Springsteen felt like it was going to be a number one, but got caught behind When Doves Cry by Prince. So again, timing sometimes, potential number one just has to be the runner-up sometimes.
And if you want to blame the song that kept Heart out of number one, it is the very next song on this countdown. Here we go, bringing it to the home stretch. We've got numbers 5 through 2.
Yeah.
5 through 2 in the Billboard Hot 100 this week, 28 years ago, June 16th, 1990. Back at number 5, it was Down after becoming Madonna's 8th number 1 of 12 she's had so far. Maybe the most influential song in Madonna's catalog. Absolute dance classic. And partly I say that because the sound, so many dance songs in the 90s would sound like Vogue. But to this day, I still feel like maybe none of them actually, they attempted, but I don't think anything sounds exactly like Vogue. It still sounds really fresh, I think, in 2018.
Yeah, I mean, definitely what a gem of a song Vogue is. It's just, there's something fun about it. Even the rap section doesn't feel forced or, you know, Madonna's trying to be cool or anything like that. It's just one of those songs that you just, and you can't help but dance to it. You just literally cannot.
She and Shep Pettibone co-wrote and produced it. Yeah. What I remember about this song, too, is spring 1990, the Bruins were back in the Stanley Cup Finals, and their goalie was Andy Moog, spelled M-O-O-G. It was pronounced Moog. And a local radio station, WVBF, also doesn't exist anymore. They did a parody called Moog.
Come on, Moog?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, goaltenders are in vogue at Stanley Cup playoff time in Boston. It's Andy Moog, whose play has been music to the ears of Bruin fans.
Goalie with an attitude, number one with the Bruins. Don't just stand there, let's skate to it. Makes a save, there's nothing to it. Moog.
Number four, speaking of Boston, New Kids on the Block, up 8-4 this week in 1990. Vogue had led for 3 weeks, Step by Step. New Kids was on its way to its own three-week rule at number one, third and last number one, but they were just the biggest thing at the time. And yeah, being in the Boston area in Braintree, my hometown, Donnie Wahlberg moved to Braintree in this era. And I remember biking over to the house. There were just kids outside, standing outside, waiting to see him. If he would maybe come out at some point. It was like you see video of Michael Jackson in Europe, people just waiting to get a glimpse. That's what it was like for Donnie Wahlberg. Bellevue of DeVoe at number three, another Boston band, holding in its number three peak with Poison. I feel like that's the song that when Finesse became so big a few months ago, everyone was kind of going back to this song, Poison, saying that's really what it takes the sound from.
Yeah, I mean, Poison probably... maybe the best known New Jack Swing song out there. Certainly not the first, but there's something about it that just lives on, you know, even to this day, you can hear it in clubs. You can hear it like it's just got the right, just that right touch.
And number two this week on the Billboard Hot 100, 28 years ago, first hit for Wilson Phillips. It was down from number one to number two, would go on to become the number one song of all of 1990 on the Hot 100. Debut hit for sisters Carney and Wendy Wilson and Chyna Phillips, who sings lead on this song. They co-wrote it with Glenn Ballard, who produced it, and he'd have more success in the 90s.
And a lot more checks coming.
Yeah, collaborating with Alanis Morissette on Jagged Little Pill. So huge era with really different sounds. This was pretty pure pop for Wilson Phillips and obviously more alternative for Alanis a few years later. First of three number ones for Wilson Phillips from their self-titled debut album. And Alex Vitoulis and I of the charts department, we hung out with Wilson Phillips a little bit a few years ago. And Carney Wilson, Wendy Wilson, Chyna Phillips, they said that really brings back great memories when they think of how they were number one back in 1990.
It was crazy. We were touring all around the world and people were throwing money at us and we were hot and sexy and we had it all going on.
That's really a frightening answer.
But
no, that's it in a nutshell. No, I have my Billboard magazine plaque, my laminated plaques on the wall of Hold On, Release Me and You're in Love, our number one records, and it's really cool to see that and walk by it every single day. Honestly, I walk by it every day and I practically want to kiss it. And maybe we'll have another one of those up.
That's very
sweet.
Wouldn't
that be great?
Yeah.
It could happen.
But the good news is that we just love singing together and that's what matters.
Exactly. Wilson Phillips on the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast, looking back at 1990 this week, Hold On, at number two on the Billboard Hot 100, which means we're up to the number one song this week. 28 years ago, it was by Roxette. It was It Must Have Been Love. And doesn't that work out well, Trevor, since Pierre Gessle of Roxette is our guest this week?
I was going to say, if you sat through this countdown and you remember Gary's little tease at the end about who was coming, you realize we have not mentioned our Swedish friends, Roxette, the duo of Pierre Gessle and Marie Fredriksson. Huge era for these two. Four number ones, of course, including this week's number one, It Must Have Been Love, but other songs, The Look, Joyride, and, you know, kind of as we mentioned, we haven't really seen too many sort of pure pop songs at this point in time. I mean, we have sort of that, a lot of late 80s rock, you know, some pop making its way through. Of course, we have the beginnings of, you know, rap and R&B taking over so much in the 90s, so for a pop duo to get, you know, to number one that many times in this window, pretty impressive, but maybe a little understated.
Yeah, absolute great songwriter, Per Gessle. Marie Fredriksson, too. So actually not recording or touring together anymore, although, as we'll find out, still really good friends. Marie has had some health issues in recent years, but Per is continuing to keep these Roxette songs on the road. He's touring coming up. So we're going to get into all this with just one of my favorite acts of all time, Roxette, celebrating the number one song this week on the Billboard Hot 100 28 years ago. Number one this week back then. It Must Have Been Love by Roxette. Per Gessle, thank you so much for coming on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll get this out of the way right at the beginning. I'm a longtime super fan of Roxette, so I'll try not to gush too much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So we're celebrating It Must Have Been Love, which was number one on the Billboard Hot 100 this week in 1990. Do you remember hearing, Per, that the news that it had gone to number one? It was your third number one for Roxette at the time. Do you remember actually finding out it was the number one song in America?
I actually remember it was number one for 2 weeks. And I remember on the second week I was in London and I was in a restaurant and I, you know, with the time changing and with time zone changing everything, I thought I have to check this out if it's still number one. So I made a phone call to New York and it was still number one. So I remember the second week, but I can't remember the first week, unfortunately.
No, I remember reading in Fred Bronson's book, the Billboard Book of Number One Hits, that when The Look debuted at number 50, it was Roxette's first entry on the Hot 100, that you knew that was pretty high at the time for a new act. So were you always a pretty big chart fan?
Yeah, I was. Ever since I was a kid, you know, it's always been. I was really sort of a nerd when I was like 6, 7 years old, you know, getting into the Swedish charts, and I started buying, you know, the Melody Maker and New Musical Express magazines, newspapers from England early on. And of course, when you start playing yourself in a band and you get a recording deal, you follow the charts and for every record you make, and it was, you know, in the 80s or even going back to the 70s, you know, when ABBA was around, it was pretty rare for artists outside of England and the English-speaking countries to have success in the States. So when we started Roxette, our main target was basically to get, you know, gigs in Germany or Holland or, you know, Denmark, whatever. But to have success in the States was unheard of at the time, so we were shocked.
And for people who don't know the story, The Look kind of by accident became a hit at first in the U.S. because a student was in Sweden, heard The Look, brought it back to Minneapolis. The radio station started playing it, and pretty soon after that, it's number one on the Hot 100.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, we were doing a big tour in Sweden at the time, and someone told me that they heard Roxette on the radio in the States. And we at the time, you know, We were, I think it was Listen to Your Heart. It was the current single for us in Sweden. So The Look was just an album opener. It wasn't a single at all. So we were really surprised to hear about that The Look is getting airplay in the States. And then we heard about this story about this exchange student in Minneapolis. And it's like a fairy tale story in a way. And it was crazy.
Yeah. You've met him since then, right? You've thanked him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Was, you know, we were going to the States, and he went with us on a media tour. So he was with us doing press conferences and everything, because everyone loved that story. And it is a great story. And it's just, I don't know, it's things that can, you know, they had a radio program in at the KDWB station in Minneapolis where the listeners actually could bring records to the station and get them on the air. So that's exactly what happened to us. You know, this exchange student, he bought the Look Sharp album by Roxette, and he gave it to the radio station. They didn't actually play it. He wanted it back after 2 weeks, so he went up and get it back. And by accident, the program director, Brian Phillips, he was standing there in the reception and saw the record. And the record is pretty special because it's got a newspaper layout, the design of it is like very special. So the program director got interested because of the sleeve, and he said, "What's that?" And the student said that this is, it's a Swedish band, and I like it a lot, and I've been to Sweden for a couple of months. And let's listen to it. And the first song on the album is The Look. So the program director, he just sort of freaked out and said, "This is a smash, let's put it on the air." And it was, you know, people started calling in and saying, "Hey, what's this? Play it again, play it again." Fairy tale story.
Are you surprised at the song's longevity? I'm hearing it in a commercial now. The song's never really gone away, almost 30 years later.
Yeah, I think one of the secrets, if there was one, for the success with Roxette was that we worked out of Stockholm, which was very, like I said earlier on, it's very rare that you worked outside of LA or New York or America or London or whatever. So we created our own sound out of Stockholm with our own Swedish players and our own producer. And so we had a very distinct Roxette sound, which fortunately for us seemed to have some kind of timeless appeal, you know. When you hear all those Dangerous or Fading Like a Flower or Listen to Your Heart or whatever today, it still sounds like it's good pop records, you know. You can hear that they have a few years. Time has passed by a bit when it comes to the production, but still it's got a very distinct sound.
Is there a secret in Sweden from ABBA to Max Martin to Roxette? Is there something that makes Sweden such a center of pop music?
Yeah, well, you know, I get that question all the time. I don't really know. I think if you go really back to the ABBA days, they were very much the exception, because they were actually the only band that sounded international. If you could listen to other Swedish records from that era, it sounds really crappy. But ABBA always sounded great for some reason. They had a great engineer and they knew what they were doing. So of course, when the digital revolution happened in the music, in pop music, like in the 80s, you suddenly get, you know, everyone was using the same drum machines and the same sequencers and the same synthesizers. So when Roxette, we created our sound in the mid-80s, it sounded a little bit more international. But then again, I think being Swedish, I mean, we come from a very, all these countries from the north, it's the same if you go to England or Scotland. We have a very strong folk music tradition, which is very melody oriented. So it's always, there's so many great songwriters here because they're really good at writing melodies. And I think that is one of the secrets with Max Martin as well. It's very catchy songs, you know, and it's the same with ABBA and same with Roxette. The more south you get, the more groove you get. The more north you get, the more melodies you get.
So speaking in particular about It Must Have Been Love. So originally, the song comes out in 1987. Was originally a Christmas record, and then sort of got the revamp in 1990 with Pretty Woman. You actually had to change it from a Christmas record with the lyric "Hard Christmas Day" to "Hard Winter's Day." And there you go. You take it from the Christmas market, you let it go live all year round. So how did that revamp come about in 1990, and who had the idea to make it into a non-holiday hit?
When we did the first Roxette album back in 1987, we tried, like I said earlier, we tried to get it, you know, into Germany and into the European countries, and we couldn't get any radio airplay. Nobody was really interested in the band, so a German record company, they told us that if you write like a Christmas song, it would be easier for us to try to get you on the radio. So I went home and I wrote It Must Have Been Love with the Christmas references in the lyrics. And we recorded it, and they didn't want it, so they never released it. But it was released in Sweden. It actually became a big Christmas song for us in 1987 in Sweden, even though it was in English, the lyrics. But then, you know, we forgot about it, and I started writing songs for the Look Sharp album, you know, which became our breakthrough album. And after we had all this success with that album, we got invited to, I remember having a lunch in Los Angeles with EMI Records, and they told us that they had the rights to the soundtrack of this movie starring Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. I think it was called $3,000 at the time. It wasn't called Pretty Woman. Oh. It was called something else. So they said we got the rights to this, and they told us that all the EMI artists were going to be on there. You know, David Bowie was on there, and Natalie Cole, and Robert Palmer. So they wanted a Roxette song, and so they asked me to write a song for the movie. And I said I can't do that because we're traveling all over the world promoting the Look Sharp album, so we won't be home for many months. But I remember, I said, I have a Christmas song, great ballad, and it's a Christmas lyric, but I can send you the song. I can rewrite the lyrics, and we can do some adjustments and, you know, update the song a bit, update the production. And so we did, you know. I changed a few lines here and there, and we did a new intro, and off it went to L.A., and I think Umberto Gattica, who was a very famous mixing engineer at the time, he mixed it, and it sounded great. And we never really thought about it anymore until that movie came out, and it became a smash movie. And I remember, you know, being in the studio in Stockholm, I got a telephone call from the director of the movie, Gary Marshall. And he said, he just said that, hey, we never met, but I just wanted to say that I love your song, and I have re-edited the movie because I don't want any dialogue over the scene. I just want your song to sort of, you know, come through for 50 seconds, you know, without any dialogue on it. And it's just the perfect, the best scene in the movie, and yeah, it's just a great, great track. And I said, oh yes, that's so cool. But then, of course, 3-4 months later on, it was like the biggest movie on the planet. So that's crazy. I remember I was really disappointed in 1987 that nobody wanted to release it, because I thought it was, you know, Marie sang it so well, and, you know, and it had a great melody, so it was a great song to begin with. But you never know. We were lucky to be part of the movie.
You're talking about lyrics in English. Was that tough at first when you started writing in English? How was that for you early on, and did it get easier over the years to write English lyrics?
Yeah, it does. That is one of the things that are so weird. When you tour over the world, let's say you play Asia or you play Brazil, you know, we're a Swedish band performing English in front of like a Portuguese-speaking crowd. And, you know, if you go to some of these countries where you perform, they don't really speak English at all, but they know all these English lyrics, right, written by me, who's not English, which is weird, yeah, to begin with, you know. But it's I started out writing lyrics in English when I was like 13, 14 years old. And then I changed into Swedish. My first band, we were recording in Swedish, and then I changed again to English with Roxette. But it takes a lot of time to adjust and to learn how to do it. I think also one of the reasons so many people have told me over the years that no English-speaking person could, or like an English native person could ever written the lyrics to The Look, because it's weird. It's a weird sort of lyric, and maybe they're right. Maybe I use that as an advantage. I don't know. If I look back to the early stuff that I wrote in the 80s, the English lyrics, they could have been a lot better.
Yeah. Are there any English songwriters whose work has helped you, you know, navigate that transition?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, I've always been very interested in lyrics, generally speaking. You know, and everything from Joni Mitchell to Leonard Cohen to Tom Petty, Springsteen, Woody Guthrie, you know, Hal David, great, great writers. So, I mean, I've always been interested in lyrics, and for me, it's very much part of my songwriting. I want the lyrics and the music to sort of say the same thing, to be on the same sort of wavelength. So it's like, I don't know, a lot of people, especially in pop music, they don't really care that much about the lyrics, but I'm really fussy about the lyrics. Fussier and fussier for every year, for older I get. Okay. I think it's important that the lyrics work.
I'll ask you the general artist question about how you write. Per, do you lyrics first, music first? Do you sit down to write? Does melody pop into your head, a combination of all that?
Yeah, in the best of worlds, it's a combination. You sit down like on a piano or with a guitar, basically write on piano and guitar, and I try to write the lyrics at the same time, or at least the lion's share of the lyrics. So I sort of get the same sort of temperature in the music and in the lyrics. Sometimes it's hard to do. I mean, I have like hundreds and hundreds of musical ideas without any lyrics on. So sometimes you just get stuck, and you just keep the music. And sometimes you do go back to your archives and you use a little bit of music and put it in like a middle eight or whatever. And so it's like there are no rules really. It's just anything goes. But it takes a lot of time. And I think it's the great ideas come really really quickly, but it takes you need to sort of sort them out, and you need some days and sometimes some space and time to really get back to them and to see how good they were. Then of course I'm as I think lots of writers are, I'm very restless. If I can't really sit down like for 5 hours and try to solve a musical problem, if it doesn't work out pretty easy, I just leave it alone and go somewhere else.
Do you remember writing It Must Have Been Love?
Yeah, I remember. It's a typical piano song. I wrote on a grand piano in my apartment in Halmstad, in the city where I was born.
Did you feel like, yeah, I might have something with this one? This has potential.
Yeah, but it was written before Roxette had its breakthrough. So every song that you worked on was important, of course, and you always were looking for like the big song. But you know, like I said earlier on, coming from Sweden, we know that it was very hard to have a international breakthrough. So I felt that it was a good song, but I felt like with many songs, the song's destiny is it's not real. You don't really control it yourself. You have to have this luck elements and timing elements and, you know, and the right networking and everything.
Any favorite Roxette songs from the catalog, or is it a little tough to pick favorites, or is it the hits, or is it some deeper cuts that maybe you thought should have been bigger hits, or just any personal favorites?
I don't work with Marie anymore. I always prefer the songs that she wrote. You know, the whole idea with Roxette to begin with was very much that I was like the writer and she was the singer. That's how we started out. That was the whole idea. So all those early songs like Queen of Rain or Perfect Day or there's a song on an album called Crash Boom Bang, which is called What's She Like, which I think is one of the best songs that I ever did.
What's she like?
But you know, she's always made my songs better than they were. Actually, I think that is one of the tricks when you work within a band or with a great producer. You have to find people who make you stand on your toes a bit, and also to make things even better than it is. You know, and I think Marie, her capability of singing triggered me to write even better songs, because suddenly I had someone who could sing them, you know. And a song like It Must Have Been Love or Dress for Success, for instance, it's just a one take by Marie in the studio. It's just crazy. I have it on film, actually. She's just going in there and singing this amazing vocal part. So, of course, as a writer, from a writer's point of view, it's very gratifying and it triggers you.
Beyond just her musical talent, was it your friendship over all these years that also added to the magic of Roxette, and I'm sure made it a lot more fun of a ride over the years?
I think so. I mean, we're small town people, both of us, and we came from sort of the same upbringing, and we were really dedicated to work really hard. We'd worked our asses off for 8 years, so much work to do, but it had to be done. But we were really motivated, and we had lots of fun, and we made some great records, and I'm really proud of that era.
One of the great hallmarks, as plenty of people have noted over so many years, is for a good song, hearing a cover version or somebody reinterpret it as their own is must be a gratifying thing as a songwriter. I know about a decade ago, I think a lot of people in sort of my generation and the younger generation were introduced to Listen to Your Heart by the cover that that group DHT had back in the mid-2000s. If you've heard that that version was a big hit in the States, what's that like for you as a songwriter to know that, you know, this song lives on in an entirely different way from a song that you wrote?
Yeah, I think it's very gratifying. I think it's great. And I mean, pop music in general, I think, is like the purpose of pop music is to reflect its era when it was born. And I think when I heard there's lots of sort of dance or whatever you want to call it, covers of Roxette tracks, Sleeping in My Car or whatever, Fading Like a Flower is very popular to do like EDM versions of. I think it's great, and I think some of them I think sounds, you know, I don't really get it, but you know, it works, and it works for a new generation, and I think it's just wonderful to have created music that lives on. You know, I think it's the same thing when you do concerts. You know, people are buying tickets to hear your songs, and that's what it's all about. You know, I'm a writer and an artist, and as long as people are interested, I'm honored, basically, because it's that's what it's all about.
So a new album is on the way, Pear, and this is a new location for you, recorded in Nashville. So that's coming out later this year. What was that like? And you worked with Nashville musicians on this album as well, right?
You know, it's just that I've been doing so many albums, especially in Swedish, in the same studio in the south of Sweden. So I told my inner circle of collaborators that we have to change studio. So we talked about going to France, and we talked about going to England or whatever. And then this idea to go to Nashville came up, and I said, yes, that's a great idea, because, you know, I've always been a big fan of Nashville and Nashville music, and also there are so many great musicians there. And I didn't really have a band at the time. So it was just the four of us, you know, an engineer and two players and me. And we went to Nashville and started using the local musicians there. And it's a very lyric-driven album. It's actually two albums. I did so many songs, it became two albums in Swedish. But it was great fun. I tried to you know, use that sort of Nashville vibe and put that into my music, which actually wasn't that hard to do, because it's very melodic and you know, getting in touch with all those fabulous players, Dan Dugmore and Stuart Duncan and Mika Raphael and all those people, it was just amazing. I was a little bit scared to begin with that they were going to think like I'm doing a third-rate country music, a country album, but they didn't think like that at all. They felt that the songs were sort of strange, but I took that in a positive way. But it turned out great, and then I realized that I should translate these songs into English and make an English album out of it, which I did, and that's going to come out in Europe in August. And I'm going to do a tour in Europe this fall as well, so it's going to be cool. I'm very good friends with Roy Orbison Jr. He's married to a Swedish girl, and he lives there, of course. And he said, "Oh, you have to use some of Dad's guitars on the record."
Yeah.
So he sent over some of Roy Orbison's old amazing guitars, the original ones. So they were lying around in the studio for like 2 weeks, and so we used them on a couple of tracks, and it was just like, you know, all these little things happened, and I felt very welcome. And the players that I never met before, the session players, they came in, and they were just amazing to work with as well. And they triggered us to do a really great, great album. And I love to go back there any day.
From the Pretty Woman soundtrack to the guy who did Pretty Woman, Roy Orbison. It's a tie-in for that.
Look at that. It all comes full circle.
Hey, it's gotta be simple. A broken heart can never keep time. What you done to me? What you done to me? I am just barely credible. I want to leave you beautiful. Pretty hard to believe. It's pretty hard to believe.
New song you have out up here, Name You Beautiful, which instant classic. First time I heard it, that same hallmark of melody that you've always been known for. Is that on the new album, or is that a standalone song?
Yeah, it is. It's not recorded in Nashville. I was invited. It's a long story, but we have my hometown, Halmstad, where I am at the moment. It's a small town. It's about 80,000 people living here. And this year, Halmstad was host for the world champion table tennis thing. So we had like 130 journalists from Japan was here. It was like a month ago or so. So the community here invited me to write the official theme song for that world table tennis thing. So I wrote Name You Beautiful. And recorded it pretty quickly, like in January or so. So it wasn't recorded in Nashville, but it's very much influenced by the Nashville sound. We used violin and pedal steel and dobro and everything. So it's definitely on the album, and it's probably the most pop top 40-ish song there is on the album. Lots of the other stuff are really acoustic and a little different.
And Per Gessle's Roxette is the name of the tour that's going to be in Europe this year. So even if you're not no longer recording or touring with Marie, you're keeping the legacy of these Roxette songs going live for fans coming up this year.
Yeah, that was a tough decision to make. I was talking to Marie a lot, and she can't really tour anymore because of her health issues, and she. And I only have two options. It's to skip the Roxette tracks or continue playing them. It's the Roxette catalog of songs has been so much part of my life, and Marie agreed with me I should do something with them. So I decided to go on a tour with a different band. I'm not replacing Marie. She's irreplaceable, but I'm using other singers and I'm singing myself, of course, and I have a great band which includes all those elements that I have on the new record as well, violin and pedal steel and that kind of stuff. So I'm just trying to get a new sort of angle to all those Roxette songs that have been with me since I was in my since the 80s. So I think that's going to be an interesting little thing and a new challenge for me as well.
And even if Marie isn't touring and recording, it sounds like you guys are still in touch, and that friendship continues on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we've known each other since we were in our teens. So of course, Marie's living a quite secluded life nowadays, but she doesn't go out that much. But we stay in touch and having dinners I try to update her a bit on what's going on with Roxette and with... Even though we're not touring or recording anymore, there's always things happening with Roxette. Like we talk about cover versions or commercials or films or TV series or whatever. There's always new things going on. It's positive things because it means that the music lives on. I think it's really cool.
Well, again, Pierre, I've been such a huge fan of both you guys for so long. So really fun to get into the backstories of some of these hits today and some of the deeper cuts. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and can't wait to hear the new music coming out as well. Thank you so much, Pierre.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye now.
It Must Have Been Love. Roxette, Per Gessle, our special guest in the Billboard Sharpie podcast, talking about the entire career of Roxette, some of his solo hits, new solo album on the way, new song sounds great. So great to hear from Per Gessle on the Billboard Sharpie podcast this week as we counted down the top 20 this week on the Hot 100 from 20 to 1 all the way to It Must Have Been Love. Just going to mention one other song, Trevor, outside the top 20 this week. Sort of a historic week. New in the top 40 at number 38 from number 51. It's third week on the chart. Mariah Carey, Vision of Love, new in the top 40. Who knew then, maybe maybe Tommy Mottola knew. How Big Mariah Would Become was her first of 35 top 40 hits so far, 18 number ones, the most by any solo artist, second only to the Beatles with 20. This was the week 28 years ago, Mariah Carey in the top 40 for the first time with Vision of Love.
I had a vision of love, and it was all that you've given to me.
So, yeah, in addition to the top 20, Mariah Carey was moving up. And as we talk about, this was early 1990, kind of getting a sense of what music was like back then. Mariah would own the decade going forward.
That's the most lamb aggressive take. I love it.
So there it is. This week's Billboard Hot 100 back in 1990. We'll talk to you next week on the Billboard Sharpie podcast. We'll be number one next week. Will Post Malone stay at number one with Psycho? I like it. Could it jump up to number one? We'll find out. Special guest next week is going to be songwriter Justin Tranter. He's going to be joining us. So he's written several hits for Selena Gomez, Justin Bieber, Halsey, many others. A big advocate for LGBT rights as well. Really interesting chat that we did tape with him. So that's coming up next week. Really fun guest.
Yeah, really fun guest. Just gotten some major accolades for his songwriting, so we'll talk about them as well. And in the past couple of years, he's been a really big advocate for several, you know, causes out there. Of course, LGBT rights right there front and center, but gun control issues as well. So we'll talk to him about his social activism, and of course, in addition to his songwriting. And really, you know, one of the most fun guests we've had on the countdown.
And don't forget, you better call.
Ooh, you better call the Chartbeat hotline, 212-493-4201.
Our new Chartbeat podcast hotline for any chart questions, comments you might have. We might play them back and respond in an upcoming episode.
All right, and wrapping things up, we're going to give our friends Roxette one more playback with a song that is very fitting for this time of year.
Fitting for June. It's Roxette, June Afternoon on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.